I think we can do this.
All right.
Technology is here. But no, let me, you know, let me echo that, because I think that we're just not going to have enough time in the day to address many of the concerns and questions that you guys will have or others will have. But I was truly impressed with the commission report, and it has a lot of great information in there and a real good assessment of how things happened, how they transpired, and good recommendations for going forward. We'll see how that plays out, but I think it was was truly a noble work, and I thank you for doing that. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about probably as expected from a NOAA perspective of how we address the spill, but even before that, I think I'll set the stage a little bit, and shame Chris had to leave, but I'll revert back to Louisiana, because prior to NOAA, I was in the corporate world for a little bit of time, for about 4 years, but prior to that, I had a 27-year Coast Guard career, and early in my career, I happened to be down in Louisiana, and this was pre-Exxon Valdez. It was 1982, and my particular job there was pollution response, responding to oil and chemical spills, and just to kind of show the perspective of even an audience like this, which is somewhat familiar with oil spills. What does anybody have a guess that first year that I was there, how many oil spills in this area? And for those familiar with Louisiana, where Baton Rouge is, that I-10 south to the coast, west to Lafayette, and east to Mississippi. And that in that area, the number of spills that would come from facilities, pipelines, tank trucks, even gas stations if they reached the navel water or offshore in that area. 150? Anybody else? All right, I'll tell you, 2,700 oil spills that year. Now, an oil spill can be anything from a slight sheen on the water, can be somebody, a shrimp vessel that pumps their bilge. But it gives a perspective, I think, that the American public doesn't have of how many of these things occur every day. Now, obviously, we've made great progress in the 30 years since then of trying to reduce that and reporting, but there's still nationwide, there's 30,000 reports of oil and chemical spills each year. Some of those are very small. Most of them fall into a category of probably cleaned up and no response before you have federal agency or sometimes even state engagement. But there's probably a handful per year, and then maybe one every couple years that gets enough national attention, it makes it on TV. And then there's a couple in our lifetime that really galvanize the American public and even the international community. And in our lifetime, that's Exxon Valdez and certainly Deepwater Horizon. So we've had that comparison, and I wanted to thank Chris for doing that. But I think it lends a perspective to we may be very well prepared for those constant but easy to handle events, but how do you get prepared for, you know, the major blowout, the one that happens every 20, 30, in this case, a major blowout in the Gulf like this happened in Ixtox just outside of Campeche, Mexico 40 years ago. So we're talking an interval of being able to be prepared. And when I talk a little bit later and we hit upon some of that research and development, you know, how are you prepared? How do you train? How do you respond? And eventually, in a case like this, how do you restore the environment? And that that truly becomes very much of a challenge and even more complex as we do this now. If we do this right, there we go. Hey. So I'll hit three main focuses today, and I do want to allow enough time for questions. So I probably will do this very high level, kind of go over it quickly, because I think it's more important to hear some of the ideas and things that you have on your mind, and I'll try to spark that conversation through my presentation today. But I'll do a quick overview of the role of what we did at NOAA and where we brought science to areas of the spill. What were some of the challenges and public concerns? And what you'll see is many of those align, but there's a bit of a disconnect. You know, it really got down to communication and trust, and speakers that preceded me have already spoken to that area. I'll talk about it a little bit more. And then maybe what we can expect as we look forward. All right. Nice picture. And we had five key areas that we provided science. And if you, I'm trying to revert back to a year ago, so that you, as we went through this bill and you're thinking about that, we were trying to provide scientific support to the decision makers. In this case, primarily the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, the Coast Guard, who was making the decisions alongside with the particular states in that area, and the responsible party, BP. We had a role in keeping seafood safe, a role in protecting wildlife and habitat. We talked a little bit about natural resource damage assessment. I can speak more to that. And then finally, where we're headed in the future, and that is, what are we going to do to restore those natural resources that were injured? So in the first one, scientific support, the reality is if you're sitting there as the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, you're looking to NOAA and the rest of your team to come up with information as to what do I need to do next? Where do I need to go? Where is the oil going? What's happened? What is happening? What's the weather outlook look like? You know, it was mentioned earlier that the government is very good at command and control, and I would say that the team that operated in this environment was probably phenomenal when you think back to how they did it. You know, 40,000 people, you know, in the highlight of it, close to 6,000 vessels, 300 aircraft every day. You know, they didn't wake up in the morning and say, what are we going to do today? They had an operational plan, and they went out and acted on it. But in order to do that, you need that information about where you need to go and what you need to do. And that's part of the role that my office played in supporting that and the rest of NOAA. How do we do it? We analyze from Earth and oceanographic data any number of ways. We had ships at sea, satellites in the air, gliders under the water, and aircraft. And then what was the best response strategy? We touched upon that a little bit earlier. Up in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the in-situ burn. I could count on my hand the number of times that in-situ burning was used in my whole career. In this particular incident, we had over 400 burns. I wouldn't have imagined that. So it was a huge number, but it was a strategy that worked and it was employed. Why did it work? Because we had a constant oil spill. It was fresh oil coming up every day from the bottom of the ocean that we hadn't capped yet. So we had very burnable oil. We had very dispersible oil. You'll see the aerial dispersants on the surface. It was dispersible even at depth and the subsurface we talked about. And it was easier to collect mechanically than it would be if it had been weathered for some period of time not out in an open environment. That doesn't mean it was easy every day. There were days where we could do none of these response strategies because the weather wasn't cooperative. There was a time when there was an impending hurricane and all the boats had to come off the water. So you have windows of opportunity, and you need to decide how to use those windows. Keeping seafood safe. This was the, and I'm waiting for somebody to tell me differently, but at this point we believe this was the very first time that federal waters were closed for an oil spill. Federal waters have been closed before to manage spills. State waters have been closed for oil spills, but federal fishing waters had not. And it was a large area, almost a third of the Gulf in the biggest area. And while I'll say it was, and I don't want to be cavalier and make this sound too easy, while it was easy to close, much harder to open. It was the right thing to do in order to keep seafood safe. You would just close an area. The area was impacted by oil. Until we could collect sufficient samples and prove that oil had not been there for some period of time, then we couldn't reopen it. But that kept a large area closed to fishing, which was obviously a concern to the economy and the fishermen. But, you know, in the end, was it successful? We'll talk a little bit about some of the perception and some of the action as I talk about areas of public concern. But I will repeat then what I'll say now. There was no tainted seafood that reached the market. So was it successful in that regard? I would say absolutely, but that doesn't mean it wasn't without concern or problems. And then you're protecting wildlife and habitat. You might even recognize that right-hand photo up at the top. It's our administrator and Admiral Allen, who was the National Incident Commander, releasing some of the turtles that have been rehabilitated or captured. Down in the right-hand side, I do that for illustration purposes. Obviously, it's not to scale. Those are the marine mammals and turtles that were captured, but it makes it look like the whole Gulf is full of marine mammals and turtles. But it does show the extent of the problem and the issue, and that really is a huge geographic area. So we had to be mindful of what strategies were we using, what equipment was going out, and how best to not impact the existing wildlife and their habitats. Assessing natural resource damage. I can talk a little bit about this. It's been mentioned earlier, there's an ongoing case. Building that case and litigating, potentially being prepared to litigate that case if there is not some sort of consensus agreement, then is a critical part of what transpired from the very beginning of the spill and goes on today. But if you look at the three pictures I have here, it really shows sort of that mixed environment that we have to deal with natural resource damage assessment. There was a subsurface piece that we haven't really had a lot of experience in. You know, when oil's coming up from a mile deep, there is a impact to that benthic community in the deep ocean, also that stratified layer between the wellhead and the surface. And even though the oil may be at a dispersed level, which it would not even be visible to the eye, even in small quantities, it does have some impact on the biological species. So being able to determine that and what damage that causes is part of it. Secondarily, there's impacts to the shoreline, and the shoreline is very different. And I show these two short types of shoreline because, you know, as Chris mentioned, the marsh and the ecosystem, very valuable from a habitat perspective and certainly things we're concerned with NOAA. But I would not want to diminish the psychological and economic impact that oil on the beaches had to people making changes in vacation plans, to restaurants, to hotels, all of which were very much of a concern, not only Mississippi, Alabama, and the Panhandle, Florida, but even in the other parts of Florida and on the East Coast. There were people making financial decisions that impacted that area based on perceptions in the spill. And then ultimately what's going to happen is when we are able to come to agreement on the amount of damage assessed, there'll be a public process to determine how the money that's going to be there will restore the habitat to the injured resources. Now, what were some of the challenges and public concerns? Some have already been mentioned. I probably will mention a few more. The flow rate, you know, how much was coming out? When was it coming out? Was it important or not important? Use of subsurface dispersants. Very first time this has been, well, there is some indication that it had been used one other time, but really the injection into a deep well, very first time the subsurface dispersants have been used. The fate and effect of the oil rising surface, what happened to it, where did it go, what was the impact, and what are some of the potential biological impacts of subsurface oil? And I put that in there because while it's important what the biological impacts are to the oil everywhere, not a lot is understood in the three-dimensional modeling, nor what the species are at those various stratified depths and what the currents are doing. So trying to make decisions as to whether to use subsurface dispersants or not was really done in a bit of a void. It would have been nice to have a lot more information, but when you don't have it and you still have to make a decision, then you make the decision on the best information that you have at the time. And this really did indicate that there's an area that we need to know more about before we go forward and have to face this same or potentially face a similar situation. On the surface, what the fate and effect of oil on surface is, how best to clean it up, not to clean it up. You know, in the marshland, they tried several things. They tried raking, cutting, washing, and depending on where it was, had different areas of success. But what was happening, how to do it, where was the oil going? We did more trajectory modeling for this spill, not surprisingly, than we've ever done. We did that probably in the first couple weeks than we've ever done for any other spill. And then, you know, this thing, you went on, and we were doing it for several months. And nobody's mentioned this today, but the concern that the public had about the loop current. This was a huge concern. It happened with governor's calls, some on the East Coast, happened with congressional briefings we did on a daily basis. Very concerned that potentially the surface oil or the subsurface oil would be picked up in what was the loop current and move through the Florida Straits and upward to the East Coast and where that might go. And a very legitimate concern. I don't know how many are familiar. I show a picture here of what actually happened where it broke off, and you had that you had the eddy. It was actually called eddy, the circular eddy that was above the loop current. But some years it does, some years it doesn't. In years past, that loop current has actually gone up to where the Macondo wellhead would have been or was, and then loop back down and through the Straits of Florida. What that impact would be, we had to think hypothetical. Probably a lot of tar balls. Where were they going to be deposited? Probably even less so on the west coast of Florida and more through the Keys and the east coast, and then maybe it would veer up out into open ocean. Maybe it would come up as far as Georgia or a little bit further. But we had people up in New England wondering if they should change vacation plans because of the potential for oil and what that impact would be. We also had, and when I get into the communications, we also had people who were not necessarily using science, but that potential fear for trying to market their own seafood, their own beaches at the expense of other areas as if that there was a huge problem. And in reality, in many areas that people theorized that there were oil, there was not. Okay, so on the surface, some of the challenges and public concerns we did have, it was the potential for the hurricane. This particular area had gone through numerous hurricanes, probably most devastating being Katrina. This was going to be a big hurricane season. NOAA had already predicted that. And at one time, we had to pull people off the water. What was going to happen to the oil if there was a hurricane? Was it going to blow away and be more dispersed? Was it going to be more of a problem because it would be pushed inland? And the answer, yeah, I guess it's hypothetical now, but the best answer we could come up with is yes. There's oil would be pushed further inland. As with any large storm surge, it was going to take some of the surface oil, some of the oil that was in the marsh, and put it in areas that it wouldn't be otherwise. We see that when we see boats on highways after a hurricane. We also know that the tremendous wind and wave energy is going to disperse what was already a fairly dispersible oil even greater. So we would have had some problems we wouldn't have otherwise, but we would have also had probably even faster dispersion and ultimately a wider spread area and then biodegradation. And then what when you're comparing what methodology to use to clean up the oil, whether it's mechanical in situ dispersants on the surface, how do you choose that? Do you do one more than the other? Do you do all three? Very, very challenging questions that have to be made in a response mentality. You don't have years to figure this out. You have hours to take the knowledge that you've gained through time and the information you have in front of you to make that decision. All right, so for the shoreline, some of the issues were, protection strategies. We talked a little bit about the burns, but also there were those who were familiar, there was something that was called the boom wars. The more boom, the better. A boom, in many cases,
serves a great purpose, whether you're using it for collection or deflection or protecting a particular area. You know, it's something that we've worked with in many areas over many years. Doesn't necessarily mean always that more boom is better. You have to understand how to use it in the strategy. You put it in an area where it can be totally ineffective because the current's so strong that the oil would go under it anyway. You can put it in an area that's very fragile, and if there's no oil that's even going to come there, if left unattended, it will itself be a destructive force into the near shore environment or the marsh. And then when we do come to different types of shoreline cleanup, it really is different whether you're cleaning up beach sand or marshes, and how clean is clean. So what are some of the issues as we look forward? Talk briefly about there has to be changes in what we do with exploration and production. The planning and preparedness. I probably should have started with this, but just to give a very simplistic idea of how people deal with the response in oil spills, there's plans that are put in place for dealing with the oil spill, average most probable worst case discharge. At that point, there's preparedness, which results in training and or exercises. Then there's the actual response, and then later on, recovery restoration. But I think that real issues and problems is that the worst case scenario for this particular area wasn't as bad as it turned out to be. We have to rethink that paradigm. You know, if the worst case isn't really your worst case, have you prepared as well as you could? But more importantly, there were a lot of entities that were involved that probably were unexpected. You know, when you have five states and you have the Coast Guard kind of managing that operation, but the planning and preparedness had been done by what was then MMS and now BOMER, it presents its own set of challenges and some lessons learned. So I think as we go forward, we'll see even better coordination, more planning together, exercises that address some of these low probability but very high consequence events. Containment and underwater countermeasures, I won't go into that. I think that's been discussed enough today. We need better modeling. My particular office is trying to work on it, and we're trying to do that throughout government to be able to provide, and with academic institutions, to provide a more three-dimensional look. We really need that for two reasons. If we disperse oil from the surface down even as far as 10 to 30 feet, we still need that three-dimensional, how is it going to disperse and where it's going to go, what the currents are doing. But any type of either deep or shallow well blowout is going to be impacted below the surface where we have limited current and oceanographic information to develop those models. Seafood safety, I mentioned that I would say something about that again, and really what I wanted to point out, and I had the opportunity to speak down in Norfolk, Virginia not that long ago, and Virginia Institute of Marine Science did a study, and they had a tremendous impact to their Chesapeake, you know, and local oyster seafood industry based solely on the fact that there was a spill in the Gulf, and none of that seafood was coming up there, but people were not eating shellfish. We also heard, it sounds a little bit incredible to me, but there was reports coming out of, you know, some restaurants up in the New York, New England area where they were having a real downturn in seafood buying, especially things like halibut, which the last time, you know, we looked at halibut, it came out of Alaska, didn't come out of the Gulf of Mexico, but people were not eating seafood because either a lack of understanding or just a bit of a psychological fear that things were tainted. And yet no tainted seafood reached the market. Fisheries closures, wildlife impacts, now that it's happened, we really need to think through what about the next time? How big a spill does it take before we feel that there might be an impact to a federal fishery to actually close that fishery? Some unanswered questions. certainly in this case, tremendous amount of oil is coming up continuously. But what about the next pipeline release or ship strike where oil goes into the water? Certainly questions that we have to work at with NOAA that have to be thought through. Research and development, I would be the first to tell you that, you know, in my time in history, that's been a huge issue. We saw a bump in money. The OSBL Lobby Trust Fund does have some money available, if appropriated by Congress, to be used for research and development. Some of that was done early on, post Exxon Valdez. But we could see as time went on, and these events did not happen, there was a higher priority need for funding in other areas, and both industry and the government did not invest as to the level that had been done previously, and it showed in this particular spill. I think that's the very nature of the business, and a very difficult area, especially in times of tough budget times. But it's important at least to feel where that priority is. I've used this forum before to ask, and I won't ask all of you guys, but I said, you know, when I asked the audience, how many people have actually had a fire in their house where the fire department came? I may get a hand. I usually get no hands. But then I ask how many want the fire department to come if there's a fire in their house, and everybody, you know, I sure do. How do you, you know, how do you keep them prepared and ready financially, but also mentally, to be able to deal with that? And that's a challenge we run in a lot of our environmental disaster planning. And I think I won't spend any more time unless people have questions of that. My last area I want to speak to a little bit is about the communications and social media. And I think that it bears some discussion because I'm not sure where that's going to go in the future. One of the things that we saw was that 10, 15 years ago, we would be prepared at an oil spill. Well, let me go back 15, maybe even more than 15 years ago. We'd be prepared at an oil spill to be able to do at least once, maybe twice daily briefings to national news on a big spill. You'd get the joint information center, you'd get all the information, you'd have the right people to speak and be broadcast. All the news agencies would be there with their microphones. You know, long about 7 to 10 years ago, you had to be prepared for the CNN world because they were going to show up with their cameras and you would have to be able to talk almost at any particular time. Deepwater Horizon, you had to be prepared for Twitter and Flickr and all the social media sites because it was being broadcast whether you wanted it or not. And you were either going to be part of it or you weren't. And the public has, right now, an insatiable appetite for information that I'm not sure that we weren't totally prepared for, but I'm not sure what the role of government or industry needs to be in that case. So I have a picture here of the geoplatform.gov, which we were able to miraculously come up with and give the public a clickable image where they could look at different things like where the ships were, how they were moving, in data layers. We had built this system for the Federal On-Scene Coordinator to make response decisions, but had not envisioned putting it out to the public, not because we were trying to prohibit the public from having it, but when your resources are focused on the operational needs of the day, you really aren't staffed or funded to be able to push all that information immediately out to the public. I think we really have to think through that as we go forward because the public's expecting it. And if you don't do it, I think you've, in a way, that you've let them down. Now, the question comes in that it's not a regulatory requirement and there's really no funding. How does the government, industry, and others prepare for that next spill when there's an expectation that information is going to be pumped out to them immediately? And then you also worry about the quality of the information and how it's going to be interpreted. But I think you can, with enough resources, you can manage that if you're prepared. I think in this case, maybe not totally, but I'll argue maybe we were well prepared to provide that kind of information to the decision makers, but we were not prepared to do more than broadcast that out through joint information to the media and the public, which was happening pretty continuously, but not in a social media mode, which we now see has really, in many responses, kind of taken over the world. So I'll leave people with that thought, because I'm interested in hearing and continuing that debate, because if it happens, you know, I'm actually, just from my staff alone, probably doubling the number of people on the IT side that would have to go down to be able to do this piece of it independent of what we're providing to the decision makers, which we do under the National Contingency Plan. So with that, I will stop. Thank you.